We are back in 5, 4.
Now, here's Mr. Midnight, Jack Delor.
Oh, good evening, Night Owls, and thank you for allowing me into your living rooms once again. Night Owls, we've got a heck of a show in store for you tonight, and I'm very excited for you to see it all unfold before your very eyes. I really hope you love it. Gosh, I hope you love it. Please love it. Love it.
I'm trying to host a cashless syndicated talk show,
and I'm trying to help you keep it on the air.
We all know how important it is to keep our sponsors and affiliates happy, but in my humble opinion, there is only one person who really matters in this whole darn crazy business. And that is you, our viewer.
You're meddling with things you don't understand.
Whoa! Now, as you know, here on Night Owls, we think it's very important to keep an open mind. Please welcome Dr. June Ross Mitchell and Lily, the young subject of the book, Conversations with the Devil.
I really don't think it's a good idea, Jack. It's becoming more unpredictable.
That's a good thing. That's why we still do flat TV.
Ladies and gentlemen, please stay tuned for a live television first, as we attempt to commune with the devil.
Lily, can you hear me?
Good to see you again, Jack.
Lily, return to me.
This isn't about ratings anymore.
No one's going anywhere.
How could you let it happen, Jack? How could you let it happen?
Please be warned, anyone with young children in the room, you're about to see...
You okay, Jack?
It's profoundly disturbing and shocking.
You get out there, Mr. Midnight. And you knock him dead.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of Fresh Cuts. This is Mike. Joining me, as always, it's Mr. Venom. What's up, Venom?
Greetings and salutations, swarmy late-night talk show hosts. How are you doing, Mike? I'm doing pretty well.
I'm doing well. We went from, at least up here in Northern California, we went from thunderstorms yesterday to, like, bright, sunny, and spring weather today. So yep. That's how it goes. Also with us, it's Don and Ellie. What's up, Don?
Yeah, what's going on? Always happy to be here.
All right. Well, no surprise. We talked about it at the end of the last episode. This week actually had a couple choices, and even three if you want to stretch like Ghostbusters into like horror, which I personally don't, but I know some people would. But we decided that we would go with the one that I think was most anticipated by us, well, at least us, the horror community at large. It's going to be very dependent, but we decided we were going to cover Late Night with the Devil first. So that is what we went with, and the synopsis is off IMDb as usual. A live television broadcast in 1977 goes horribly wrong, unleashing evil into the nation's living homes. All right, nice and conspicuous there. Doesn't give away too much, so... Let's see, Late Night with the Devil, 2023, but actually 24 release, hour and 33 minutes in rated R. Let's get our general thoughts on the movie. Venom, you are the freshest watch out of all of us, I believe. So what did you think of Late Night with the Devil?
Okay, before I get into my review, I have to make this joke because we shared it at the theater, and it was a packed theater today, by the way. I just watched it today at 12:30, literally 3 hours ago, and yeah, packed theater. But the question I want to ask is, do you guys, and I'm speaking to the listeners too, do you guys remember the episode of Family Guy where Peter and Lois go to the movies? And before the movie starts, it's literally an endless run of studio logos. And every time a new studio logo plays, Peter thinks that it's the movie starting, and then he gets disappointed when he realizes it's a logo. Well, if you remember that episode, my friends, this is that fucking movie. Because there are no less than 6 film studio logos at the start of this movie. It ended up turning into a joke in the theater. After the third company logo, there was a little bit of laughter in the theater. After the fourth logo, there was a big laughter. After the fifth logo, there was laughter combined with groaning. After the sixth company logo, it was just groaning. And then finally, when the television set, the first frame of the actual film, comes up on screen, we got a thunderous applause in our theater. They were so happy that there were no more fucking film studio logos at the beginning of this. I had to communicate that because it was one of the funniest things I've experienced in theaters this year. The entire theater cheered when the movie started.
Wow, Linda McMahon popped for a TV screen.
Exactly. Oh my god, it was so fun. Anyway, let's get into the movie after that little anecdote. My friends, I am so happy to announce that for the second week in a row, we're reviewing a damn good movie. Now, obviously, we did stop motion last week, which left all three of us wanting a little bit more, but I think we all agreed that it was a very solid movie, very well made, blah, blah, blah. Here we are, week number two in a row in 2024, and we've got easily a top 10 candidate for the year. My friends, it's like this movie was made for me. I am a child of the 70s. I am an old man, yes, I admit. I was a big fan of stuff like Johnny Carson and late night television in the 70s. Also, just 70s television. I mean, both of my parents worked full-time, so I was basically raised by the TV. So when I saw the presentation, how it was a 70s talk show presentation, even in 4:3 aspect ratio, like it just reminded me so much of my childhood. And even before we get to the horror of this film, I'm thoroughly entertained because I'm getting – this movie has all the best parts of the WNUF Halloween special and Ghost Watch and other films and television shows like that. This was just a really, really fun time. Like I said, even when before any of the horror started, there are some interesting characters out here. You know, we got a psychic, you know, doing mind readings in the audience. We get a skeptic who used to be a magician who now spends his time debunking things like demonic possession and magic tricks and whatever else. And they were both thoroughly entertaining, even though really nothing too menacing was happening. There was a little bit of creepiness with the mind reader, but man, overall, these performances just really, really stellar. Once again, David Dastmalchian just steals the show. I mean, he's supposed to steal the show in this one. He is the star, but just absolute great performance. I mean, this guy does such a good job of being sad 1 minute and then the next minute having a big beaming smile on his face, because ultimately he is a late night talk show host. You got to be smiling. So he pulls that off so perfectly. Our possessed child, Ingrid Torelli, who plays Lily, I thought she did I actually liked her performance pre-possession. Post-possession, it was just very basic. You know, it's all the best parts of Regan McNeil and Jennifer Carpenter and, you know, Haunting of Emily Rose. Just, you know, good solid possession stuff, you know, speaking in tongues, doubled up voices, cracked skin, crazy eyes. You know, we've seen it before. We'll see it again. But this girl's performance before the possession, I just thought was spectacular. The way that she was so giddy to be on TV, she couldn't stop looking into the camera, smiling a big ear-to-ear grin. Now, obviously, that could be potentially the inhabitant inside of her grinning because it knows what's about to happen. But this little girl, this was a great performance. But like I said, all the performances in this movie just really worked for me. The co-host, Gus, the stage manager, the lighting director, just everybody that was in here just really put in some great, believable, organic performances. And then once we do get to the horror, it is pretty damn gnarly, my friends. I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to call this a gore fest by any stretch, but we do get some pretty gnarly kills in here. Few and far between, unfortunately, and they're kind of concentrated. Well, few and far between is actually the wrong way to put it. They're all kind of concentrated in the third act, and they happen really, really quick. But they are still really cool to look at. You know, when the girl finally is possessed, again, solid performance from her. I love what happens when, let's just say, the demon exposes itself in a manner of speaking, let's say. I thought that effect looks great, the way that they combined it with almost like the VHS quality of the 70s. Again, another movie that this one reminds me of, and I think it's going to remind most people of, is, of course, The Cleansing Hour from a couple of years ago. Pretty much the same premise, you know, a demonic possession. That one was specifically an exorcism that they wanted to perform on television. This one doesn't come off as wanting to perform an exorcism. They just want to kind of try to prove that this girl is possessed, with some pretty awesome results. So, yeah, great performances. It's an hour and a half. It's a quick watch. I mean, I couldn't believe it when it was over. I was literally expecting like 10 to 15 more minutes. And no, the 92-minute runtime had run its course. I was pretty surprised. No post-credit scene to speak of, so just a fun movie, potentially my favorite experience of the year. You know, like I said, with the logos at the beginning, and then just, it was a really fun crowd. When you watch a movie with a respectful crowd, but a crowd that knows how to have fun, it makes the movie that much better. And yeah, this crowd was awesome, laughing at the right times. Gasping at the right times. It was just a really fun experience overall. And I'm not even going to say potentially. Fuck that. This is my number one movie of 2024. You guys know I love demonic possession. You guys know I love period pieces. And this movie checks off so many boxes for me. So, yeah, like I said earlier, it feels like it was made for me. But if you grew up on television or late night talk shows during any period, 70s, 80s, 90s, the aesthetic is still there. It's a very familiar aesthetic. And just the way that the horror set pieces kind of devolve and, you know, turn into something else, like I said, especially in the third act, really well done. The movie actually left me with some questions that I'm going to, ask my co-hosts here after we get through our walkthrough, because there's a couple of things that happened in the movie that I'm not sure if they actually happened or if they were hallucinations. So I'll see what my co-hosts think later. But yeah, overall, the most fun I've had at the theater this year. Great movie. And I would say that even non-horror fans, I think, can get into this, because there's legitimate comedy, both intentional and unintentional. Like I said, great performances, great filmmaking, just really a time capsule, if you will. So, yeah, I can't recommend this movie enough. Of the three movies that opened this weekend, this is by far my favorite. I have, fortunately, I've seen two of them. The third one I'm holding off on, as Mike said, you know, Ghostbusters. Is it horror? I don't know. But it's fun nonetheless. So I will eventually check that out. But yeah, this was by far the movie of the weekend for me. A very high recommend. And I'm just going to leave it at that, because I could talk for about an hour straight about this one. So back to you, Mike.
Let's kick it over to Don for his general thoughts on A Late Night with the Devil.
Yeah, I can't disagree with anything Venom said. I kind of hyped this up a few weeks ago when I said that, it was worth it, and I'll just leave it at that. I kind of feel, not that I was pushing it towards you guys, but it's just one of those where I did see it a few weeks ago. So, I knew this one was going to be an absolute blast. And, man, this one was so much fun. Maybe not just because we've had so much crap hurled at us this year, but I think just in general, I think this one would have been one that stands out regardless of what it was up against. But yeah, compared to what we've seen so far, this thing is head and shoulders above everything else. I don't have the personal experience to know a lot of the, I'll say, aesthetics. Venom was talking about. I don't have that experience. I kind of came into that kind of stuff like late 80s, early 90s, so I don't have like the 70s approach. I have, I don't have like fond memories, but I was much more Jay Leno, David Letterman kind of late night talk show host. That was the ones that I was allowed to stay up and watch it, 11 o'clock on Friday nights. But yeah, the whole approach here is so much fun. I love the fact that it's the uninterrupted broadcast where we don't get, you know, everything cut up, and it feels like it's one continuous shot. You know, I mean, it switches around, you know, to different cameras, but it feels like this genuinely is like a one take kind of an approach. You know, it bumpers to, you know, you see them like in between commercial breaks where they're berating each other or setting up what the next segment's going to be or interacting with the audience while the crew kind of does their thing. To me, that kind of is the stuff that really helps, you know, get me into the mindset of what's going on. And when it gets to the third act and it gets to the possession part of the storyline, this thing is great. I love the set pieces here. I think I know what you're coming at, and you know, with the you know, was it real, was it not kind of a thing. I think I know where you're coming from with some of that, but I mean, again, we'll get to that, you know, when we get to it, but. This one was, you know, a great time. The witty banter, the, you know, interludes, the intermissions, the, you know, the back and forth nature that, you know, he has with the audience and, you know, his various guests and crew. Yeah, it just made for a fun time. And, yeah, I can't say that there was anything wrong with it. I'm not going to, you know, touch the AI issue. I think that is a non-issue. But yeah, there's so much to like about it. I mean, yeah, maybe you don't have as much, you know, bloodshed and body parts flying all over the place, but I think this one works in spite of that. It just has such a breezy atmosphere to it. The backstory kind of makes it feel darker than what it really is, especially when all the, you know, the secrets get revealed and all the set pieces kind of start dropping. And yeah, I don't really want to say much more, just, you know, out of fear for spoilers, but I mean, you know, one of the best of the year, one of the highlights of the decade for sure. Especially over the last couple of years, you know, there hasn't been a whole lot that's been like really, really like top-notch, like, go out and see it kind of a thing. I think in most years, this one would be a, you know, standout heavy hitter. And, yeah, again, no contest for me, film of the year. So, again, just, you know, out of fear of not saying anything too spoilerific, you know, back to you, Mike.
All right. So we're going to be pretty unanimous on this one. This is easily my favorite of the year so far. I can't say it'll be my number one at the end of the year, only because we haven't, you know, we're still early in the year, but if there's going to be if there's going to be nine better than this, then they bet work cut out for them by the end of the year. That would bump this outside of at least a top 10 list. But yeah, so for me, like, these late night talk show, yeah, I was too young. I was born in 80, so I didn't live during the decade that this was in. But I did catch a lot of like the aesthetic, like in syndication and reruns, sometimes in the 80s, and I would see. So I had like a little bit of experience, but I thought this was a great like peek into it, especially for younger audiences that have no reference points to what kind of TV late night talk show hosts were like back then. I love the prologue of the movie to kind of like set you up with the character, give background of like how he got where he is and what the purpose of this specific episode within the movie, I guess, that they're showing, and why it's such a big deal, why it's important. Kind of gives you like, or it sets up the motivations of the character, which that character probably already had motivations just because he was on TV trying to get ratings, but it was extra important for kind of this episode to succeed for the future of his show and all that. I love the fact that we got to look at kind of the background of these shows and how frantic it can get when they're trying to set up future segments and when things go wrong that the audience isn't aware of that they have to change on the fly or fix or maintain. I love that. I love hostilities between like the crews of the show and people are in kind of disagreement with proceeding in certain ways when some people start to show some real concern and how that conflicts with the main character's motivations. I love that we get bits and pieces of foreshadowing and clues as to what's going on that come back to hit later. I think it's well done, even down to the name of the show, which I'm not even going to say because I don't want to like spoil and give any of that away, but we can definitely get into that during spoilers. And just overall, yeah, I think I appreciate that we got the setup we did that led to the third act because, to me, I think it makes the culmination pay off more if you kind of get a slow, steady build to it. I didn't need everything from the third act. Like, I've heard some people say, like, oh, it took too long to get where it was going, but I disagree. I think you need the build-up. I think if you start a movie too early with that stuff, then it starts to lose effect over the course of its running time, and I thought this handled it great. And I agree with Venom, the actress who plays the patient or the girl, the demon-possessed girl. Yeah, the subject. I thought she did excellent. And the thing is, it's like whenever a possession movie deals with a young girl being possessed, you're never going to escape certain tropes. They're just going to be there because so many possession movies involve like a young teen or preteen girl somewhere in that age range. So you know some of the tropes are going to come along with it, but the mission of the movie itself is to create something like a unique experience around that and something entertaining, something fun. And I thought this movie succeeded with flying colors in that. And then the finale, I mean, we can talk about where it went. Bonkers is where it went, and I was here for it. And I can't wait to kind of break it down. And I might have questions too. Ben, sounds like he has questions, so we can get into all that and try to figure it out for ourselves, the answers. But yeah, overall, go see this movie in the theater. Like I'm surprised. Out of all the movies that got a release this week, I have a feeling that this one will be the shortest because this one feels the most like they took a chance getting it into theaters. Not that it doesn't deserve it, because I think it deserves it, and I am super glad that this one made it to theaters. But I would say this one probably needs the most word of mouth help, just because it doesn't have like the major studios behind it, and it's not getting like the most advertisement. Well, so,
well, it's also going to Shudder next month. I think it's the second or third week.
Yes, I think it's April 19th,
after Stop Motion hit Shudder. Yep.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like the second or third week, so I think they're just putting it out there just to kind of like, okay, you know, here's kind of early word of mouth preview kind of a screening.
Yeah, and I hope, I haven't looked up any box office stuff, but I just hope that it does enough to where like there's future considerations for like these kinds of movies, because if we can see more of this in theaters, that would be great, just to give us something different than what we're getting from like the major studios. So I'll probably leave it at that for general thoughts, because I back up pretty much everything that's already been said. So Venom, I'll kick it back to you.
It's funny because last year we got potentially one of the most original demonic possession movies ever made, a film that was all of our number one movies of 2023. Of course, I'm speaking about When Evil Lurks. We couldn't praise it enough for all of the different things that it decided to do, and also being one of the least religious demonic horror possession movies ever made. This movie, even though it does fall on some very, very long established exorcism and demonic possession tropes, it's still so well done that you don't mind it. I've said it before and I'll say it again. I'd rather see an unoriginal movie that's done well as opposed to an original movie that sucks, you know? And this movie, though not the most original thing ever, we've all kind of said it, I mean, we can see the references of at least a half dozen movies in this film, But despite all of that, the film is so well made with some great performances, great score, too. That was something else I didn't mention earlier. The score for this movie is great, really, really well done. The way that they incorporate the late night band's music and then into the more orchestral score as the horror set pieces happen, just really, really well done. And like I said, so despite this not being the most original exorcism movie, it's still endlessly entertaining. It's fun. It's funny. It's, you know, terrifying might be a stretch, but it definitely gets tense towards the end.
Two things I'll mention that I forgot during my general thoughts. One, I love the kind of the trope they kind of play on almost as a joke, because like it got a kind of a chuckle out of my theater when the possession stuff starts happening and one of the characters tries to do something that might be familiar to everyone who's seen possession movies with a cross. Got a chuckle. And the other thing I totally skipped over, I love the guy who played the skeptic. I thought that was he was great. And he got a actual moment to shine in the movie with a demonstration. That was just – that whole sequence was amazing as well.
Exactly. Yeah, big time. Really cool the way they did that particular sequence. Obviously, we'll get into it in detail in the walkthrough. But, yeah, that particular sequence was actually really really well done. And, yeah, I agree with Mike. Ian Bliss as the skeptic, Carmichael Haig. And I don't know if that's a homage to Sid Haig, but, yeah, anytime I see that last name in a movie, I always think of Sid, and it makes me smile. So I'll take it. There's actually an actress in this movie named Haig, too. Georgina Haig actually plays Jack Delroy's wife, the cancer patient. So we've got two Sid Haig references in this cast list, so I kind of like that. But what can we say negative about this movie? I mean, if anything, yeah, maybe a little bit more of the demonic stuff, because we only get two major scenes of possession in this movie. One that's set up like a demonstration, and then one where the shit hits the fan. I would have liked to have seen a little bit more demonic action, but it really doesn't deter me from saying this is the best movie of the year so far. As I said earlier, even when the horror stuff isn't happening, the 70s late-night talk show aesthetic is just working for me. I mean, I could have watched a two-hour movie of just, you know, Jack Delroy doing standard episodes, like nothing horrific happening. It just I'm so entertained by the aesthetic that it just worked for me, so... what else can we talk about? Anything else you guys want to bring up before we get into the walkthrough?
I mean, I'm just kind of used to not speaking just out of fear of saying spoilers.
Another thing that I really liked about the movie, too, that I didn't actually mention that I think I can bring up here in the general thoughts, is there's some goofy moments in the movie, but because the movie is shot or set in the 70s, it works. Like, there's a newsreel in this movie about a demonic cult, a satanic cult, the Cult of Abraxas, or the Brotherhood of Abraxas, whatever the hell their name was. That footage looks so goofy, but that's very similar to footage that you would have seen of cults in the 70s and 80s, just that over-the-top, ultra-satanic, just goofy footage, you know? Like, real Satanists don't do that shit. It's kind of interesting that that's the trope that folks like me have been tagged with, but yeah. But even though it was goofy and silly and very laughable, it worked in this film because, again, it's a 70s aesthetic. And then that story of the cult kind of ties in later to our main story in a really cool way, with a group or organization, a club, if you will, that we'll also get into during the walkthrough. So, yeah, I did want to bring that up. That was really well done. All right, folks, this is going to be your final spoiler warning. If you have not seen Late Night with the Devil, what are you waiting for? Get out to the theater, support this movie, and come back and find out some more detailed thoughts of what we thought of some of the spoilers. Otherwise, if you've seen the movie or have no interest in watching it, go ahead and stick around. So here we go, my friends. Our movie opens with six film studio logos, but once the movie starts, it basically starts almost like an intro that you would have seen in a 70s talk show. You know, we hear a narrator kind of telling the story of Jack Del Rey. This is our main character, Jack Del Roy. He is a local radio DJ and comedian who in 1971 was given a chance to host a late night talk show on their local channel called Night Owls, which is a pretty good name for a late night show. It's pretty cool. It works. And after a year of doing that show, it actually became a big success. He wasn't quite doing Johnny Carson numbers, but the longer the show went on during that first year, the closer and closer he got. After that first year, Jack gets himself a 5-year contract with the television studio, not the local affiliate, but with like a national syndicated network, and Night Owls goes national. And you know, we start seeing newspaper clippings of, like, you know, Jack versus Johnny Carson, because obviously Johnny Carson was king in the 70s of late night talk show, and you know, Jack is nipping at his heels. During all this, we start to get personal information about Jack. We find out that he married the love of his life, and that they amongst Hollywood circles they were considered, you know, one of the most loving marriages out there. But unfortunately, his wife developed lung cancer. A non-smoker developed lung cancer. Man, how do you not blame your husband? Because, of course, Jack Del Roy is a chain smoker in this movie. He's constantly smoking. If he's not actually in front of a camera, he's smoking a cigarette. So obviously, his wife got, you know, lung cancer from his secondhand smoke, but she never begrudged him. You know, she it didn't seem like she held any grudges. And actually, a couple of weeks before her death, she made an appearance on Night Owls with her husband, talking about how they met, because she's actually an actress, too. She was like a vaudeville, or either Broadway or, Broadway, not vaudeville. Vaudeville's long gone by the 70s. Broadway actress. And like I said, she's in a wheelchair. She's got an oxygen tank. She looks just terrible. And then 2 weeks after that TV appearance, she passes away. Jack ends up disappearing for about a month. Nobody knows where he is. He's just gone. Most people think he's going to quit the television show, because at this point, I think he's 4 years into his 5-year contract. His wife actually died in 1976, the year before this movie takes place. And so, like I said, they're deciding what they want to do for Sweeps Week. Hardcore TV viewers know that Sweeps Week is usually something that happens at the near the beginning of the television season in September, October. It's basically a week where networks will put on their best shows. They'll pull out all the stops, you know, whatever they can do to get viewers' eyeballs. And that kind of – they can use that information to then set up, like, funding and advertising and everything else for the rest of the fiscal year. So it is Halloween night, 1977, and Jack decides he wants to do, you know, a show that kind of concentrates on the supernatural. He has a mind reader named Chris Du. Yes, Chris Du. C-H-R-I-S-U. T-U. Chris Du. I thought it was Christ 2 when I first saw it, but yeah, Chris 2. And he basically is a mind reader. He comes out, he does his segment where, you know, he does the John Edwards thing where he's like, I'm hearing a name. I'm hearing Patty. Does anybody know a Patty? Blah, blah, blah. He doesn't have any success at first, but then he runs into a pair of women sitting in the front row. He ends up correctly guessing that their son committed suicide very recently. So obviously this shocks the audience, and, you know, everybody's gasping and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and then he starts talking about different bits of information that only the family would know. Like he says, who's Papa? And the daughter's like, well, I mean, our dad was always around, but we never called him Papa. And then the mother interjects and says, no, Papa was the name of his stuffed animal that he had as a child, something along those lines. And so obviously the crowd is very convinced that this guy's for real, blah, blah, blah. He's about to end his segment. You know, since he successfully, you know, did a reading, he was about to end his segment, but then suddenly he has an attack of some kind. Like, you know, we see his veins start to kind of fill up. We see his face turns flush and red, and he starts asking, "Who is Millie? Who is Millie?" What, you know, almost like a spirit is yelling at him. You know, he's on his knees, holding his hands over his ears, just screaming, "Who is Millie? Who is Millie?" No one has any idea who Millie is in the audience. And then suddenly the lights in the studio all go out for like a second. They come back on, and then Christu is fine. He's like, the spirit's gone. They're not speaking to me anymore. And that's pretty much it. The TV show then goes to a commercial break. And what's cool about how it's presented in the film is when the show goes to a commercial break, when the actual program is on screen, it's presented in a 4x3 presentation the way it would have looked on your television in the 70s. But then when they go to a commercial break, they go to behind-the-scenes footage of stuff that happened during those commercial breaks. That then expands out to 16:9 to the full, you know, cinema screen aspect ratio. And this is where we see how maybe not everybody on the crew gets along. There is a black dude who is the lighting director who's basically getting all of the blame for all of the crazy stuff, the flickering that's happening with the lights. He's claiming, I don't know what's going on. I'm not seeing a problem, you know, but he's still catching the blame, probably because he's a black man in 1977 working at a white TV studio, but that's just me guessing. So eventually they come back from commercial. Christo doesn't really want to stay on the show. You know how usually on a late night talk show, the guests will come on, they'll do their skit, and then they'll stay on stage, like on the end of the couch for the rest of the episode. Christu didn't want to stay there. He wasn't feeling good. The stage manager or the director, I'm not sure who the guy is, basically tells him, oh, I think you want to stay. Just stick around. Christu ends up staying. And then when we come back from commercial, we're introduced to the next guest on the talk show, and that is Carmichael Haig. Carmichael Haig, played by Ian Bliss, is a former magician who is now a skeptic and debunker. He basically spends all his time now debunking ghost stories and demonic possession and magic tricks and things like that. So he comes on to the show, starts making fun of Christu, saying that, oh, this is stupid, this is, you know, anybody who read a book about mind reading can do this stuff, there's no actual mind reading involved, blah blah blah. And, you know, they kind of go back and forth until Christu finally gets insulted enough that he picks up a glass of water and splashes it into the guy's face. In the guy's defense, in Haig's defense, he doesn't react. He just kind of sits in the chair, almost like he expected it. It's not the first time he's probably had a drink thrown in his face. And then Christo walks off stage. He's going to get off the stage, but the door, the entrance to the stage is closed. It's blocked. You know, it only slides open when a guest is coming on or off stage. So the co-host, Gus, convinces Christu to kind of stick around. Christu starts to walk back towards the set, and then he collapses and starts puking up fucking black viscous oil. Like, not blood, but literally just some black viscous liquid of some kind. Looked like oil, like I said. He ends up puking it towards the skeptic and on parts of the stage. He's obviously concerned. His wife shows up. Christu's wife shows up. She ends up taking him to the hospital. We'll put a pin in Christu for now. We will be coming back to him in a little bit. So, again, we go to another commercial break. You know, we see some more interactions between members of the crew. We see how Gus has the call list for the show. When you're on a show, there's something called the call list, and it's basically it shows you all the segments, what the exact time that they're going to be on, how long they need to run, things like that. And there's something on the call list for the end of the show that Gus isn't familiar with. And he's trying to ask multiple people on the crew, hey, what is this segment? I don't remember this being planned. What is this? No one seems to know what the segment is. And everybody just ignores him because he's just kind of the co-host. You know, no one gives him any respect. Nobody gives a shit about him. So eventually we come back from commercial. And, you know, Haig is still on stage there. And then this is where we introduce the next guest. And these are the guests, of course, that we care about. He introduces June Ross Mitchell. She is a parapsychologist who has a new book out called Conversations with the Devil, which is a study of a girl named Lily Dabo. Now, Lily is the survivor of the aforementioned satanic cult that I talked about earlier. This is where we get the news footage of the Brotherhood of Abraxas or the Cult of Abraxas, whatever, the Church of Abraxas. It was something along those lines. But they were calling Satan Abraxas, which is an acceptable term. It is one of the many names that Satan has used over the years. They show them being goofy, you know, having ceremonies, almost alluding to the fact that maybe they were doing human sacrifices, even though the footage doesn't show us anything like that. It kind of alludes to that. Like, we see Xandar Dabo, the leader of the cult, with a, you know, ceremonial knife, and he's about to put it up to a girl's throat, but then the camera cuts. Now, the story is that the cult leader, Xandar, commanded everyone in the – I'm skipping ahead a little bit. What ended up happening was kind of a Waco situation where the government, the U.S. government, started to kind of have their eyes on the Brotherhood of Abraxas, and they were worried that that there was a guns and drug situation potentially happening amongst the cult members. Eventually, the police try to siege the house. They don't even have a compound. It's literally a house in a suburb. Like, it looks like a two-bedroom, you know, Victorian house, Victorian-style house in the suburbs. But the SWAT team show up. A gunfight ensues. During the gunfight, and this is very similar to, you know, David Koresh in Waco, what we are told as the audience is that the leader, Xandar, commanded all his cult members to douse the house with gasoline and douse themselves with gasoline and then light it up. What we see from outside the house is the house just burst into flame. And suddenly, you know, after a couple of minutes of this standoff, the house is completely engulfed. It's just a giant fucking bonfire. As it turns out, there was one survivor of the cult. And that was this little girl, Lily Dabo, a 13-year-old girl. She's 13 now. The cult was actually taken down a few years earlier when Lily was a little bit younger. And as it turns out, June Ross, the parapsychologist, believes that Lily is harboring a demon inside of her because of her time with the cult there. We are then introduced to Lily and June. They come on to the show, and as I mentioned earlier, Lily is absolutely adorable. She's just this cute little 13-year-old girl, big, big beaming smile on her face. Like she wouldn't want to be anywhere else. She's literally very happy. She comes off as a fan of Jack because, you know, she's very happy to meet Jack, and she's very polite to him, almost like an adult would be, like very conversational, not standoffish like a child would generally be. So then we come back once again from another commercial break. During this commercial break, though, we find out that Christu has died. He apparently never stopped puking up the black stuff and was puking in the ambulance all the way to the hospital, and he basically died in the ambulance. He never even made it to the hospital. So we have our first real death of the movie. Is it because of Lily and her inhabitant? We'll have to see. So they start to interview June and Lily. You know, they start going over the story that I just went over here, and Jack starts to speak to Lily. And he asks Lily, you know, do you believe that there is someone inside of you? And she says, yes, definitely. And Jack asks for a name. Apparently, whatever demon it is that's possessing Lily didn't actually give her a real name, said to call him Mr. Wriggles. And the reason that she calls him Mr. Wriggles is because he wriggles his way into your mind and then he wriggles his way out. That's literally the joke that she made. Audience laughs, thinking it's a joke, but now she actually calls her little passenger Mr. Wriggles. Now, what happens is the skeptic, the entire time that Jack is interviewing June and Lily, the skeptic is making snide comments. And when June talks about that she has a PhD in parapsychology, you know, of course, he says what from the University of Hogwash, or, you know, he's making comments like this. Eventually, June says, "Is this productive? You interviewing me with this asshole sitting here making comments?" And this guy, I forgot to mention that this guy actually has an outstanding challenge. If you can prove that something truly is paranormal to him, he will give you a check for $100,000. Literally, and it's the same check that he carries around with him. He's had with him for years because no one's ever proven, you know, the paranormal to be true. On this day, on the day of this show, he's so convinced that June and Lily are lying that he pulls out his checkbook and he writes a check for $500,000, half a million bucks. And this is 1977, my friends. Half a million bucks, that's more money than you'll probably need the rest of your life in 1977. Anyway, after writing the check, Jack, the host, actually asks June, can we see the demon? Is there any way that you could summon him, or, you know, so that we could see Lily in her possessed state? Obviously, June is a legitimate parapsychologist. She doesn't want to do it. She's like, no, this 13-year-old girl cannot handle this. I don't want to just be willy-nilly summoning the demon, which fucks her up every time it happens. But eventually, the crowd starts kind of cheering, come on, June, do it. And then finally, the skeptic is like, oh, she won't do it, so don't even bother. But then finally, she says, okay, if I can get everyone's concentration, I need everybody's, you know, agreement that they're going to be quiet. Cast, crew, audience, literally silent as the grave is what I need. Everyone agrees. They go to a commercial break. They come back, and June and Lily are sitting facing each other in the middle of the stage, you know, where the host usually does the monologue, not from the couch area. And June starts, you know, asking Lily to close her eyes, count backwards to try to fall asleep, you know, whatever it is that she needs to do to hypnotize her to basically put her to sleep so that she can then speak to Mr. Riggles. And of course, you know, this is where the movie gets really tropey. The girl falls asleep, she pulls up her head, and suddenly her hair is a mess, her skin is cracked, like both of her lips are cracked open. Like I said, it's almost a carbon copy of Linda Blair in The Exorcist. I'm not complaining, mind you, but, you know, it is tropey, it's what we've seen before. And then she starts to speak, and we get that doubled-up voice where we hear Lily's voice, but then we also hear a dark, demonic voice at the same time speaking in rhythm. And it's reverberating all through the studio. So, of course, the skeptic thinks that it's, you know, a trick with the microphones, whatever the case may be. June continues to ask Mr. Riggles some very basic questions. And then Mr. Riggles turns his head, you know, Lily turns his head towards Jack and says, "Hi, Jack. Nice to see you again." Jack is like, "I don't know what you're talking about. I don't think we've ever had the pleasure of meeting." And then Lily, in Mr. Riggles' voice, says, "Oh, we've met before. We've met in the tall trees." Now, I'm sure that's a reference to something. I did a little bit of research. I literally only had like 10 minutes before between getting home and starting the recording today. So I did a tiny little bit of research to see if I could find any references to In the Tall Trees. The only thing I could find is that there is a story. There's actually a novel called In the Tall Trees, which is the story of a little girl who's dealing with a cruel world all by herself. She's part of a secret family where the dad has his real family, but then he has a secret family out in the woods, you know, with a couple of kids and a wife, and the wife is actually chained up by her ankle in the basement. So I've never read the book, so I don't really know where it goes from there, but that's like the basic setup of that book. I don't know if that's what the reference is.
I'm pretty sure The Tall Trees is a reference to the Bohemian Grove cult that they referenced at the beginning of the movie when they're kind of about his during the prologue when they're talking about his rise to fame and kind of giving background on him. The thing is, it's like a small breadcrumb in that segment, which I think it might be easier to pick up on a second watch, but they go through, a men's only kind of, I don't think they refer to it as a cult, but like maybe like some type of
club.
Men's only club, out in the woods. And exactly. I think the tall trees is a reference to that.
That makes total fucking sense. Thank you. I just wasn't thinking about the grove. Yeah, I forgot to mention, folks, that during the video segment at the very beginning of the movie, one of the activities that they talk about Jack engaging in is he's part of a club called The Grove. And it's a private club for men. They meet out in the woods. We see some very basic footage. It looks kind of culty, like some of the people are wearing robes. At one point, they show a guy drinking out of a chalice while kneeling in front of a person with an owl head on. So it definitely looks very culty. But yeah, thank you guys.
That's also why I said in general thoughts, why I like even the title of the late night show, the Night Owls, kind
Night
of
Owls.
A reference to that. Yeah.
Very nice. That's awesome. Mike's on the ball today. Very nice. Awesome. Okay. So let's see, where are we? We're at the possession. After she says we met in the tall trees, she starts talking about his wife and how, you know, why couldn't you save her, Jack? Why couldn't you save her wife? Basically implying that it was, you know, his secondhand smoke that gave her lung cancer and killed her. And then she starts doing, again, a very obvious homage to The Exorcist, where she starts going, now we can fuck her in hell. And she starts repeating it over and over. Now we can fuck her in hell. Now we can fuck her in hell. This is on live TV in the 70s, mind you. It's funny because the first fuck gets through, but then they edit the next couple. I thought that was kind of interesting. Again, live TV. You know, you got to prepare for that. After she kind of goes on that tirade about, you know, fucking his wife in hell, the chair starts to levitate. Lily, oh, by the way, Lily's strapped into this chair, you know, obviously to not hurt herself or others. The chair starts to levitate. It levitates maybe 2-3 feet into the air. While all the lights in the studio are going crazy, we see like electrical current, like blue electrical current running through some of the lighting, like throughout the film. Even at during the finale, we'll see that electrical current return. So all this crazy stuff is happening, and then finally when she comes back down to the ground, she looks at the Dr. June, and she says, oh, June, I know you think Jack is attractive. Oh, June thinks Jack is attractive. And then she starts saying, you know, Jack and Jill went up the hill to fuck each other's brains out. Like, I think that was word for word the nursery rhyme that she said. And right then and there, June slaps her, like right on live television, just slaps this 13-year-old girl across the face. Apparently, that slap was enough to get Mr. Riggles to go away, or at least that's what we think, because then after the slap, it's Lily again, and it's Lily's voice, and she's like, why would you slap me? You know I can't control it. And, you know, June, of course, is apologetic, you know, I'm sorry, it's just, you know, you were saying some terrible things, or Mr. Riggles was saying some terrible things, blah, blah, blah. They, once again, they go to commercial, they come back from commercial, everybody's back up on the couch area, and of course our skeptic is skeptic as hell, even though he literally just sat there and witnessed all of this stuff. Then he decides to do a presentation. He's like, I'm going to debunk what you did right now, and here's what I'm going to do. So he asks Gus, you know, the co-host, the goofy co-host, to volunteer, to be his volunteer. What he ends up doing is he pulls out a stopwatch, you know, very traditional, and it looks like he's going to try to hypnotize Gus. But then he has the camera, the studio camera, zoom in on the watch that he's holding. And suddenly he starts waving his hands over it, and the hands start moving faster and faster. Then he waves his hand in front of it one more time, and it turns into that traditional black and white spiral. Just, you know, a spiral that you would stare into and potentially, you know, get hypnotized. After this, he starts talking to Gus. And, you know, he starts saying, so, Gus, I hear that you're scared of worms. Like, you have a phobia of worms. And he's like, how did you know that? And, you know, he just keeps talking. And suddenly, Gus says that he's hot. And he takes his jacket off. He takes, like, his blazer off, throws it on the floor. And then he starts to realize that he's itchy. He's like, wow, why is my neck so itchy? So he starts taking his shirt off, like undoing, he takes his tie off, undoes his shirt, starts scratching his neck, which looks visibly red and raw. And we see a little cut on his face. And the skeptic basically says, oh, it looks like you have a cut on your face. And he says, oh, yeah, I nicked myself shaving this morning. But then the camera zooms in on the nick, and suddenly it's a gash. It's a big fucking gash. And the skeptic looks at Gus and says, what's that? We see Gus grab towards the part of his neck where the cut is, and we start seeing him pull worms out of his neck. And literally everyone is reacting. Everyone in the audience is reacting. The host and June, you know, over at the couch area, they're all reacting. It's like they all see the worms. Suddenly, we start to see, like, his, you know, like, underneath his skin start to wriggle. And he's like, oh, God, they're inside of me. They're inside of me. I know they are. And literally, he takes his shirt off, digs his fingers into his belly, and tears his belly open in what is a pretty damn cool practical effect, honestly. When he pulls his stomach open, just an abundance of worms, like a mass of worms start coming out of his stomach. Again, the audience is reacting. Jack is reacting. Everybody's freaking out because we're watching this as the audience, and we're seeing, like, worms spill onto the floor. It's a pretty cool-ass scene. And then Gus starts, like, kind of motioning towards him, like walking towards him, and actually gets on top of his chair. The skeptic has gotten up. He's not in his chair anymore, but Gus is basically begging, what is going on? I don't understand what's going on. And then suddenly the skeptic snaps his fingers. And everything is back to normal. There's no worms. There's no cut. There's no cut on his neck. His belly isn't torn open. There's no blood or worms on the floor. Everything disappears. And suddenly everyone in the audience is like, what the fuck is going on? Like, what is this? Was this some kind of trick? And then after yet another commercial break, we see Gus and Haig back in the couch area, and Jack is like, what the hell did we just watch? How did you do that? Then the skeptic says, well, why don't you go back and watch the footage that you recorded of that segment? So they go back, they watch the footage, and we see something completely different this time. This time we see the skeptic feeding information to the guy, to Gus, as he's hypnotized. You see him say, oh, your neck is getting hot, huh? Oh, man, there's something wriggling under your skin. Like, this is all stuff we didn't see the first time. But as we're watching it in the video footage, we see him grab his neck and act like he's pulling out worms, but he's not pulling out anything. There's nothing there. And then we see him undo his shirt, and he goes to grab for his belly and act like he's tearing it apart, but he's not actually tearing it apart. He's just doing the motion. And then the footage ends, and that's when the skeptic goes, see, I made you all believe this. It's just the power of suggestion. That little girl right there is not possessed. Her chair did not levitate. You all were made to believe that's what you saw. So then the little girl, Lily, says, well, why don't we go back and watch my footage and see? And Jack, the host, is like, okay. And he says to the skeptic, well, cameras don't lie, right? Just like you showed us with your segment. So they go back, they watch Lily's segment. It looks exactly the same. We see the chair levitation, her face getting distorted, the double voice. Everything is all the same. The skeptic is obviously kind of freaked out, like, oh, you must have used tricks or something in post-production to, you know, to do this, blah, 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 blah. You know, the eternal skeptic. And at that point, June just gets pissed right the fuck off. She actually stands up and says, what the fuck is the point of all this? I did not hypnotize the audience. I did not hypnotize anybody in the studio, anybody at home. I did nothing. And of course the skeptic is like, ah, shut up. You know you did. You just did it in a different way than I did it. You know, well, whereas I used a watch, you know, you probably did something that was much more subliminal that nobody would notice. And then at that point, that's where the shit hits the fan. At this point, Lily stands up and starts screaming. And she doesn't quite look like herself. She looks like she's being recorded on like a VHS tape. So it's got that, like, just around her body, it's got, like, that glitching VHS kind of video quality. And we see a bolt of energy come out of one of the cameras and grabs her by one hand. And then we see another bolt of energy come out of one of the lighting fixtures from above them and grabs her other hand. So she, Lily, is basically stuck in the Jesus Christ pose. You know, it looks like something is holding her arms out. Suddenly, she gives this gut-wrenching, fucking soul-crushing scream. And I'm not exaggerating, folks. Her head fucking splits open lengthwise. Literally all the way down to the neck, well, to the mouth. To the lower jaw. The lower jaw was still intact, but everything above that split completely open. We don't really get to see what's inside there. It just looks like there's more of that VHS quality glowing blue light coming out of her head. But then suddenly, Gus, the dumbass who apparently has watched way too many movies, like Mike said earlier, pulls out a crucifix that he's wearing on his chain, and he starts saying, you know, the power of Christ compels you. Don't forget, this is 1977, so it's only 3 years after The Exorcist, so it's still pretty popular. So literally, Gus is like, the power of Christ compels you, the power of Christ compels you. Everybody in the theater is laughing at this point. The demon, or Lily, with her split head, looks at him, just makes a hand motion towards him, and his fucking head does a complete 180. Just snap, just all the way around. We even get the cool-ass snapping sound effect. I like that. I like when they add that bone-cracking sound effect. That's awesome. So Gus is dead on the ground with his head backwards. The doctor, you know, the parapsychologist, June, she's trying to get Lily to calm down. Like, she's not even really freaked out by the fact that Lily's head is just split open lengthwise. She's trying to get Lily to calm down. Suddenly, we see Lily again do a hand motion towards the doctor, and suddenly the chain that the doctor was wearing wraps around her neck and picks her up off the ground. She's literally just hanging by a gold chain that's wrapped around her neck. Eventually, the gold chain gets so tight that it slits her throat. You know, we get that great blood splash, and her body just falls to the ground. At this point, right, and then the skeptic. The skeptic at this point realizes, oh, shit, I fucked up, and he, like a dumbass, he pulls out the $500,000 check and tries to hand it to Lily with her fucking head split open. I'm sorry, that shit made me laugh my ass off. Of course, Lily looks at him, makes a hand motion towards him, the check bursts into flame and just, you know, deteriorates. But then he starts to do that, the Raiders of the Lost Ark melting, you know, from the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark when they open the Ark of the Covenant. Literally his flesh and skin start melting, and he's melting just completely. His flesh is melting off his bones, and finally he just kind of falls over dead. At this point, everybody in the studio is dead except for Jack. And Jack is basically, he's still on the set, but he's like behind all the action, kind of hiding. Then him and the crew try to escape. They try to get out of the studio. We see the stage manager or the producer, whoever that guy was, tell Jack, let's get out of here. Jack then goes ahead and walks out the door, but then this is where the movie starts to get hallucinogenic as fuck. Basically, he walks through the door, but instead of still being there and walking out of the studio, it transitions to a shot of him walking back out at the start of the show. You know, I mean, we get the intro again. We get Gus saying, here's Jack Del Roy. And literally everything starts over. Jack is on stage like, what is going on? Why am I here? Everybody else around him is acting normal. Gus is making a joke. Oh, you know, you got here by taking Melrose to 42nd Street or whatever the hell he said. Everybody laughs, blah, blah, blah. But he's freaking out. He's like, what is going on? Why am I here? And then this starts happening more and more, where he starts transitioning to different times during his career at the show. we see him transition, like, almost like he's waking up from a blackout. He wakes up and suddenly he's in a new skit. Like, we see him in the caveman skit that they reference earlier in the show. We see him doing an interview with someone. Just, it keeps resetting on him. Finally, we get to a scene where a door slides open and it's his wife. It's his wife literally on her deathbed, on the brink of death. All her hair is gone. She's completely pale white. I mean, she looks like something out of Dune, you know, just not natural. And we see her kind of telling Jack, I'm in so much pain. I'm in so much pain. We see the dagger, the ceremonial dagger that we were introduced to earlier from the cult. It's sitting on a table next to the bed. Jack then takes the knife, and the wife says, you know what you have to do. I'm in so much pain. Please, please, you know what you have to do. Jack, you know, looks like he's reluctant, but he does end up taking the dagger, stabbing his wife in the midsection, which kind of freaks me out. Like, wouldn't it be better to stab him in the heart? Like, you don't want her to suffer. He stabs her in the fucking stomach. Anyway, at the exact moment that he stabs her in the stomach, once again, he comes out of yet another blackout, but now he's back to where we started. We're back at the set of Night Owls during that episode, and we see him holding the dagger in Lily's stomach. Yeah, so when he thought he was, mercy killing his wife in the hallucination, he was actually killing Lily on live television. Which is kind of funny because earlier in the night, Lily alluded to the fact that, oh, don't worry about your popularity. You're going to be incredibly popular when this night is over. And then she gives a little sly smile. And that's it, folks. I'm pretty sure it ended right there with the image. The camera basically pulls back and shows, Dr. June dead on the ground, Lily with the dagger in her belly, Gus with his head backwards. We're just right back to it. And Jack's character basically just keeps repeating, the dreamer has awoken, the dreamer has awoken, the dreamer has awoken. And fade to black, and that's our movie, folks. Late Night with the Devil, 2024. Fucking awesome. And I didn't give it any justice. Like, obviously, with my walkthroughs, I'm not going to go over every single little scene. Like, I didn't go over every single commercial break individually, even though all of them are fairly entertaining. Like, there's little bits of information that are exchanged throughout all the commercial breaks. So, yeah. Solid movie, just a great, great movie. I can't believe this is a Shudder original, because this is 2024 has not been kind to Shudder, but apparently they finally found their diamond in the rough. So kudos to the filmmakers, kudos to David Dastmalchian, and this entire cast, especially Ingrid Torelli as Lily. Just like I said, I loved her throughout this entire movie.
Was your guys' takeaway that his wife was the sacrifice?
Yeah. See, that was my question. My question was, the wife was the sacrifice because as it seemed like they were alluding to the fact that he made a deal with the devil at the Grove.
Mm-hmm.
They don't say it in so many words. What's up?
No, that's what I was going to say. That's how I took it as well.
Yeah. They kind of imply that he made a deal with the devil or with somebody, some demonic entity, for popularity. They wanted, he wanted his show to be the number one late night show. And he was told that there would be sacrifices, but was never told what the sacrifice would be. So, yes, I'm assuming that his wife getting cancer and dying was his payment for, getting what he wanted from the devil. But the question that I had, though, the burning question that I had, to use one of our terms, did he actually kill his wife in real life? Like, was that a flashback to something that he actually did? Or was this a new hallucination? That's what I was confused about. Did he mercy kill his wife in real life, I guess, is the question I'm asking. Do you guys think he did?
I don't think he did. I think that was just the... I don't think he did. I think that's just the, whatever entity that he used for this entire process. I think that was just their way of tricking him. Like, the entire deal is not that he's going to get popularity by having a great show. He's going to get popularity because he's going to kill somebody on live TV. And yeah, he's going to possess, you know, they're going to possess Lily, and they're going to torment him to the point that he's going to stab her, thinking he's being tormented by the spirit of his dead wife.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, that surrealism was kind of meant to set him up, I think, to end up killing her.
It's just really weird, though. Like, why would they, I don't know. Like, why would he mercy kill his wife in a hallucination if he didn't do it in real life? That's what's freaking me out. Like, I
think maybe he's not realizing it's a hallucination. I think he's just, by that point, his mind is almost gone as to, like, what's real and what's not.
I'm going to disagree, because I think he knew it was fake the whole time. Don't forget, he starts repeating, stop watching, stop watching, like in the middle of a hallucination. He's looking in the camera and telling people, stop watching. I think he knew he was, I mean, because don't forget, as soon as the shot cuts to back to the beginning, back to his intro, he knows there's something wrong. He's like, why am I back here? What is going on? And every time the scene changes, he knows he's not supposed to be there. When he's dressed as a caveman, he walks off stage because he doesn't know what the fuck is going on. It's like he's reliving things that he's done. That's why
I think that's what's cluing him in. I think he knows that there's something wrong, that maybe it's not just his wife being the sacrifice is all that's going to happen to him. I don't think he knows that he's going to end up killing the girl. I think that's the entire end game is the devil's going to get back at him, and he's going to be popular by killing Lily. But they're showing, I think they're showing the hallucinations as a way of unraveling him to the point that he justifiably lashes out at them to protect himself. But then that's the incident that goes after to kill Lily. I think that's
I don't think he would have willingly done it.
No, of course not. I'm not questioning the killing of Lily. You guys aren't listening. Did he mercy kill his wife in real life? That is the question here. Because I'm convinced he did. I'm convinced he did, because every clip, every time that he would come out of the blackout, he was reliving something that we already saw earlier in the film. So why would all of those be real and then just the last one not be? I'm convinced he mercy killed his wife in real life, and that he's been living with that guilt. Even though he was doing something good because she was asking for it. She wanted to die because of all the pain she was in. I could be wrong, mind you. I'm completely open to being wrong. But I just don't understand why the filmmakers would choose to have these series of flashbacks that were real, that actually happened, and then the last one didn't.
If he was aware his wife was the sacrifice, then he would have had guilt just over that, whether he actually would mercy killed or not.
Well, no, he wouldn't have known that she was the sacrifice when he mercy killed her. He didn't know that this was his payment or his penance for, you know, his success until the end of the movie that we're watching. So when his wife died, at least the movie doesn't allude to the fact that he knew when his wife died that she was the sacrifice. I think he made that realization during the events of this film. Again, my interpretation, I could be wrong. I just don't understand why the filmmakers would choose to let him do flashbacks of things that actually happened and then the last one didn't. You know what I mean? Like I said, I understand the end game. I understand the intention of the scene. My only question is, did he mercy kill his wife in real life? Because I am convinced he did. And I don't really have much basis for that other than what I've already said, which is fairly thin, admittedly. I'll be the first one to admit it's fairly thin. But that's what I took from it. That's all. Mm. That's all I'm saying. I think he mercy killed his wife, and he's been living with that guilt. Because ultimately, you're doing a good thing, you're ending her pain, but you're still killing your loved one. And there's got to be a sense of guilt that goes with that, you know, with an assisted suicide, you know, of a loved one. So I don't know. Yeah, like I said, just an interpretation. I'm very open to being wrong.
The only way I could see it maybe happening is if there's more allusions throughout the episode where it's not just, okay, it all of a sudden pops up at the very end. Like, if there's if there's more allusions to like a stabbing or a shooting or maybe something like that happening throughout, maybe there would be something. But I mean, yeah, it's just only the very end. So I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe we'll meet their director someday and we'll ask him. Or the writer. Is it?
Yeah.
The
only reason I thought he might have known before, like before the ending, it was because they kind of made a point that what she had lung cancer, but they made it a point to say she never smoked a day in her life. Now, right. I know he smokes, so you can make the connection she got the cancer from secondhand smoke, but I thought they were kind of alluding to the I thought they were setting up the breadcrumbs right there to say like she was a sacrifice.
So
I assume he knew it too, but maybe not. I think we've only seen it once.
I'm trying to think about what Venom's saying, and Venom is saying, okay, the sacrifice is the wife gets cancer and she's going to die. But I'm thinking he murdered her before she could pass away naturally, and that's what the possession is about. The possession is getting back at him for taking part in that unnaturally, where even though she's going to die normally, he murders her before, and then this is coming back to get him for that. Because even though she takes part in the sacrifice anyway and she gets the cancer anyway, she dies, him mercy killing her, she dies before that can take place naturally. And so now the entity is after him because he took part in that and he didn't let it fulfill it. He didn't let it fulfill. So I think that's what you're trying to get at.
Oh, wow. I fucking love that explanation. That was awesome. I wasn't even thinking about the fact that he might have interfered with the devil's plan by mercy killing his wife. Now I'm convinced he mercy killed his wife. Don just convinced me 100%.
That's what I'm saying. Is that
so you're saying that the mercy killing of the wife kind of removed the natural portion of the deal?
Right. The natural portion of the deal is that she was supposed to have gotten lung cancer, and they sort of lampshaded by him being a heavy smoker. So, okay, it seems plausible where it wouldn't be, like, out of the ordinary. Like, okay, a normal mortician can look at it and say, okay, there's enough evidence here. It's secondhand lung cancer, secondhand cancer from all the smoking that he got. So it's a plausible way for her to die and still fulfill the sacrifice that he made to gain popularity. But because she has cancer, he mercy kills her before that can take place naturally. So now there is nothing that can be, the deal can't take place because she didn't die by the cancer, she died by him. So now the possession comes into effect as a way of taking back the deal by saying, okay, now you're going to become popular and here's how you're going to do it. You're going to kill this girl on live TV.
And these types of bargains are like monkey paw scenarios. It also never turns out like the person thinks. It's like, yeah, you might get like the temporary fame, but something bad is going to be associated with that fame. So it all kind of ties together. So it's,
well, that's a given.
True.
Yeah, that's absolutely. But Don's explanation is fucking spot. I love it. I don't even know if it's correct. I'm calling it correct. Because think about it.
Yeah.
The demon would want the wife to go through a certain amount of pain. That's his penance for getting his popularity. By mercy killing her, he's saving her from some of that pain. So now the demon is pissed off because she didn't go through everything she was supposed to go through. I love you right now, Don. Fucking awesome. Yes. Perfect. Perfect. We figured it out.
And well, thanks to you. I mean, I kind of just made the dots as you were saying it.
I laid the dots and Don connected them. I love it. This is why we talk, folks.
they kind of also allude to him having an affair with June, right? Maybe when his wife is on the deathbed or something.
I don't think it was an affair. I think they were just interested in each other. They did allude that they were kind of romantic. I don't know about cheating.
I'm not saying that they confirm it. I'm just saying there's kind of seeds planted that, like,
I think it's more a case of. I think it's more a case of.
Hasn't it been like a year since the wife died? So.
Well, I was going to say, I think it's more a case of, oh, your wife died? Here, use my crotch as a comforting tool.
Yeah. I don't think there was any cheating even implied. Because like I said, it's been a while since the wife died. He disappeared for a month, and then he's literally in the final year of his contract. So, I mean, a lot of time went by, is what I'm saying. And it's not like they even kiss or hold hands or anything. They just kind of get a little close at one point when they're having a conversation. Their heads get a little close. And then with Lily saying, you know, oh, June thinks you're attractive, you know, there's obviously an attraction there.
It kind of seems like they already know each other, though.
They definitely know each other. I mean, if that's what you got from it, awesome. You know, I'm not necessarily going to disagree. I'm just going to say, well, I didn't see it.
I'm just saying,
don't forget, they called them the most romantic Hollywood couple ever, how loving they were and how they were always, you know, in each other's arms and blah, blah, blah. I understand guys like that can still cheat. I'm not ignorant, but I'm just saying, I don't think the movie even implied that.
Well, he's also willing to make the sacrifice, but...
Oh, that, definitely.
Yeah. And then you can also make the case that, like, June, against her own medical professionalism or whatever, was willing to bring that patient on the show to sell more books. I mean, you can take it like that, too. Like, so she wasn't, like, innocent in any of this either, even though it leads to her own demise as well.
Yeah, I have no idea why she decided to. I mean, obviously it's good for ratings to bring the girl with you, but it should have just been her talking about her book and talking about Lily, but bringing her on there, like, that doesn't even seem, even if Lily is not possessed, it seems irresponsible to bring a 13-year-old, you know, on national television who survived a cult, you know, so she's going to have this stigma on her. People are going to know what she looks like now as she gets older. It just seems like a poor decision all around, but good for ratings.
Unless that was the plan of the devil all along.
The devil, she wasn't, man. He's crafty.
I was going to say, it's not like he was going to plan on her being alive at the end of the show.
Oh, hell no. Yeah. I don't think anybody was meant to survive that shit, other than Jack, of course. Oh, man, we could talk about this movie for another hour, I think. so much to unpack.
Yeah. I'm going to say, yeah, I was, like, trying to scan through explanations to see, like, how close we are to, like, what other people are saying. It seems like everybody is, like, kind of around the same idea of what we're saying. Everyone kind of has their own little bits and pieces, but we're all kind of, like, right there.
Yeah.
Everyone's trying to reconstruct the event.
Yeah.
Yeah, everyone's trying to reconstruct, like, the order of, like, events as, like, exactly where in the timeline he meets with the cult to make the sacrifice versus gets famous versus when the wife dies versus, like, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Well, everyone's kind of around close. Yep. But anyways, yeah, that's probably going to wrap up our discussion, which could go on forever because there's a lot of theories around it. Yeah. But great movie. Probably number one of the year so far. But yeah,
I can't imagine.
That is late.
I agree. It's going to be a top 10 candidate. I can't imagine it's going to be my number one. And I only say this because in the, 9 years that I've been podcasting now, whenever I watch my number one movie the first time, I have a certain, like, holy shit type thing. Well, when I saw When Evil Lurks the first time, when I saw The Sadness for the first time, when I saw Tigers Are Not Afraid for the first time, it's like that first watch, it's so eye-opening, and, like, I end up sitting in the theater for, like, 5 minutes after the house lights come on because I'm just in such awe of what I just watched. This movie is great, but I did not get that feeling. So I think I can confidently say this won't be my number one, but I think it probably will be a top 10 candidate. I mean, obviously it's number one right now. That's a given.
Yeah, I'm thinking it's going to be the same. I'm thinking high 3 max, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I would say if it makes my top 5, it's a pretty shitty year.
Yeah.
And that's not talking down on the movie. I gave this movie an almost perfect rating. Not quite a 10 out of 10, because I do keep my own ratings, even though we don't do ratings on this show. But yeah. I gave it a damn near close to perfect rating.
Yeah, I think so. I'm 9.5 if we were going that far.
Yeah, same here. Yep, exactly.
Yep, all right, cool. Well, Well, that will probably wrap things up for this episode, but let's find out what else we got to listen to. So, Venom, what do you got on your list?
Mostly the same stuff I talked about last week. No More Room in Hell presents Creature Comforts. Episode 24 is available now, where we looked at 1995 Species. On next month's episode, we will be looking at Godzilla vs. Kong 2, trying to get a review for that out as soon as we can after opening day, so look for that one in the next couple of weeks. No More Room in Hell presents the Crystal Lake Gift Shop, made its triumphant return this month with episode 4, where we looked at episode 4 of the Friday the 13th series, which of course was called A Cup of Time. And once again, our friend Lacey Liu joined us for that one, so check that one out. And the main show. We finally got the main show in the can. Ah, that's right. Yes, we finally recorded the next episode of the main show. I believe that's episode 58. On that one, we looked at a couple of Mike's selections, which he'll probably talk about when he goes, so I'll let him do that. But that is, I don't know if that's available as we speak, but it should be out, I would imagine, later this week if it's not already out, so look out for that one. And I think that's pretty much all we have. Obviously, a new episode of Fresh Cuts every week, but 2024 is looking like we're hitting a slightly higher cadence for episode releases. You know, I wouldn't have guessed we'd already have two episodes of the main show in by mid-March, but look at that. So let's hope we can keep that frequency going and maybe even a little bit more, because we already know what we're going to do on the next show. I already selected my movies. We haven't announced it yet, but I'm hoping to get that episode recorded sooner than later. Like, hopefully not another 3-month wait in between episodes. So look out for that one sometime in April. And that's everything I have.
All right. How about you, Don?
Yeah, not much. The Creature Comforts episodes are, available. Definitely looking forward to our next show, which is going to be a lot of fun. The guest spot I did on Horror Returns is still out there. Not the most recent episode, but, if you're interested, I think it's 2, maybe 3 episodes back, but at least by the time you hear this, but it's a Giallo double bill, so you'll find it pretty easily if you go through their stuff. And the only other thing is a couple of guest spots that's coming up. One I had to, guess which was a kind of a common occurrence. I had to re-record it, but hopefully we'll be able to get that one out sooner rather than later. I guess that's pretty much it for me. One last thing, just kind of caught my mind. I am going to kind of alter Horror Countdown for the rest of the year. I may have to recount this, but I think I'm 1 or 2 episodes away from 100. So rather than doing a, calling out a new guest spot, I'm probably just going to take what I have, finish off the year, and then maybe do a special thing for episode 100. So that'll be I didn't realize.
You could do like your top 10 favorite episodes of your show.
Maybe. Like I said, I think I have to recount, because I think with what I have so far and what I have coming up, I think I'm close to 100 when I put everything out. So I would have to recheck just to confirm everything and, get everything lined up accurately. But I think I'm close to 100. So I'm probably just going to, call my season early, not really do much, and then either start season 3 with 100 or end season 2 with 100. So in the meantime, I'm going to, instead of doing it every week, I'm going to do it biweekly just to make it spread out. Because if I didn't do it otherwise, I'd be done by the end of April. So, I don't have much left. So instead of just doing a new series, new series of guest hosts, I'm just going to call the season early, get to 100, and then just do something special for it. So, as of now, there's no episode, but I'll be back next week with a regularly scheduled one. So Yeah, just keep an eye out for that, and yeah, we'll go ahead and I guess back to you, Mike.
All right, so pretty much my stuff is just what Venom also mentioned. The main show that was recorded, we did our No More Room in Hell, episode 58, where we covered a couple of William Castle movies, Homicidal and Straitjacket, so that was a double feature there. And we talked a lot about what we've been watching and covered some news. So all the usual stuff on the main show. But other than that, our next episode of Fresh Cuts is more than likely going to be on Immaculate, one of the other horror movies that are released this weekend. Mm-hmm. So look for that in about a week from when you're listening to this. But other than that, that's all I got. So thanks, everybody, for listening to another episode of Fresh Cuts. Hey, maybe 2024 is going to start turning around. You never know. This is a big step towards it if we can get off on like a rally here. So I guess that's it. Let's say bye to our listeners.
Later.
Never antagonize the devil.
Peace.